Hey Beeps, it's me, Christine, and I want to share with you a game-changing product that has improved my sleep and daily health. So let's dive in. You all know through my journey, I have struggled with sleep, being afraid of it, not getting quality sleep, and not being able to regulate my temperature throughout the night. I definitely learned the hard way, but sleep matters big time. It's when your muscles repair, your brain detoxes, and your body can work on cellular renewal. We just can't afford to miss out on an adequate amount of high-quality sleep, which is kind of hard when you have a rare disease. There's not much that I control in this real life, but one of the easiest and most effective ways to get better sleep every single night is through temperature regulation. Studies actually prove cooler temperatures lead to a deeper, more restful sleep, and that insomniacs actually lack this natural drop in core body temperature, which is what keeps them up at night. Personally, I run hot. This means that even if my room is super cold, I wake up in a pool of sweat, uncomfortable, changing my clothes several times throughout the night. It's frustrating for obvious reasons, and this is why I was so relieved to discover this transformative product from Chili. The Cube from Chili Sleep is a system that fits right over the top of your mattress and uses water to control the temperature of your bed, which helps lower your internal temperature and triggers deeper, relaxing sleep. Since water has 30 times more thermal conductivity than air, these systems are a lot more effective than just cranking up the AC. I mean, I keep my house at 65, so it has to be true. Ever since I started using the Cube system, I've noticed I fall asleep a lot faster, sleep deeper, and wake up feeling fully rested. Now, my wife is not a polar bear like me and likes to sleep a little bit warmer. So I love that we can each have our own temperatures on either side of the bed. Chili products can range between 55 and 115 degrees. Right now, Chili is offering my audience a really great deal. When you go to chilisleep.com/findyourrare20, you get 20% off the Cube All Sleep Systems with Find Your Rare 20. Sleep is something we could all use more of, and we can all take small steps towards getting better sleep to improve our life in big ways. I hope you'll check out the Chili Sleep System and see why I love their product so much.
Hey peeps, welcome back for another episode of Because We Are Strong. Today we are sitting down with a very special guest from the UK, who has been nominated for a WeGo Health Award this year and is a fierce advocate. Fez has had 3 kidney transplants. That's right, I just said it, 3. But he continues to fight not only for himself, but for others through mentoring and his work as an organ donation ambassador. I'm your host, Christine.
And I'm Teresa, so let's dive in.
This is the Because We're Strong podcast, where we sit down every week to get your stories and insight on how to navigate this rare life. You can expect everything real and raw, in the hopes that your story, along with ours, helps another person who is dealing with a similar rare struggle. So grab your favorite drink, a comfy blanket, and buckle in, because rare disease isn't for the faint of heart.
Welcome, Fez.
Hi, guys.
Yeah, I'm so glad you're here.
Yeah, it's nice to be invited and nice to talk to you guys.
Fez, we met you through Clubhouse and you have a pretty incredible story. Will you please tell our listeners a bit about yourself and your transplant story?
Sure. So I was born with kidney failure. So I've had it since birth, pretty much. And I had, the very short version is I had my first transplant at 3. Then I had a live donation from my father at the age of 14. And most recently, during the pandemic in July 2020, I had my third transplant.
Oh, I'm sorry. I hate to interrupt you, but I can't believe, like, 2020, like, oh my gosh, sorry. I just had to have, like, a, That must have been so much.
Yeah, it's been a very strange year, and a bit more than a year, to be fair. But yeah, it's been a strange time. Just going back a little bit, so my first transplant, we got the call on April Fool's Day, so it almost didn't happen because my father thought it was a prank call.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So they ended up bringing twice or three times. And eventually, thankfully, my mother picked up and she was like, no, this is a real call. And we should kind of take him in because he might potentially get a transplant. So that's how my first one went about. My second one, at the time, I was on peritoneal dialysis. So dialysis is kind of a process where when your kidneys stop working, dialysis is kind of the replacement medically of how they can kind of substitute your non-working kidneys via machines and dialysis. There are two types of dialysis. There's peritoneal and there's hemodialysis. So peritoneal, basically, they put a catheter into your peritoneum. They put special fluid into your peritoneum. It stays there for a little while, and via osmosis, it kind of all the like yuck stuff that the kidneys would get rid of, it kind of via osmosis kind of sucks that through the peritoneum, and then it drains out. So I was doing that. At first, I was doing exchanges. So exchanges pretty much means you do it periodically through the day. So some people might do it 3 times, some people might do it 4. And then I eventually went to do APD, which is automated peritoneal dialysis. So it was done overnight via a machine. So the machine would do all the timings and know when to put the fluid in, how long to leave it in, and then drain it back out again. So during those kind of 18 months, 2 years, whilst I was on peritoneal dialysis, my father did the workup to be a live donor to myself. This was in like the year 2000 approximately, or 1999. So it was a long time ago, and the process may be a lot faster now. Yeah, it took approximately 18 months, but that was a while ago, so it may now be a faster process. And we actually, our date that we got booked was Star Wars Day, so May the 4th.
Love it.
Yeah, right, in the year 2000. So that's when I received my father's kidney. Unfortunately, when I was at university, so I'm old now, so it's been a while. It's been at least a good 10 years, if not more. Again, I started to feel symptoms of kind of rejection and not feeling great and things like that. My parents came pick me up from university. I had to withdraw. Emergency dialysis was done for about a week or so. Also, medications were given to help stop the rejection of that kidney. Fortunately and unfortunately, I guess there's two ways of looking at it. They did manage to salvage some function, but unfortunately the damage that had been done was irreversible. So they could see that the function was slowly kind of going down. And so they preemptively in 2012 or 2013 preemptively put me back on the transplant list. Because I'm from an ethnic minority, and the donation rates within our communities of people of color are not that great here in the UK, but they are being improved, which is promising. And also the fact that it would be potentially my third transplant, so I already had quite a lot of antibody buildup. They preemptively put me back on because they knew. They kind of estimated that with the whole two factors going on, it was going to be quite a wait for me. So, yeah, I was preemptively put back on, and I had to pretty much maybe about 6 months, maybe a year of that function kind of survived. And then I had to start training for hemodialysis. So basically, the difference between peritoneal dialysis and hemodialysis. With hemodialysis, they generally make an access or an AV fistula on your non-prominent arm, where they join the main artery and the main vein together. So the blood flow is quite strong, and whilst you're on the machine, the blood flow is strong enough for the blood to go through the machine, to be processed, to be cleaned, and then the cleaned blood goes back in. that's a very simplistic way of kind of, I guess, explaining hemodialysis. I had the operation first on my arm to make the fistula. That was given time to kind of recover, heal, and mature. So it was kind of ready for use. And then I had to get my head around hemodialysis, which was very strange. Also, at the time, obviously, I had left university. I wasn't sure what was going to happen with my life. Like, I didn't know job-wise what I was going to do. I was kind of already expecting a very long wait, as mentioned. So it was like putting my life on hold again, which I had already done as a teenager and at birth. Obviously, at birth, I didn't remember much. It's more stories I've been told by my parents. But yeah, it kind of gave me reminders of what it was like as a teenager. So I missed a lot of schooling. My social circle shrunk very small. So I was kind of expecting similar things. When starting hemodialysis, I did have a fear of needles. So needles are placed into the fistula, two. So one is drawing the blood out for it to go through the machine. And then once it's coming back from the machine, it goes up through the other needle in that. I started hemodialysis, and at first, and it was probably maybe even a few sessions a week or so, I was doing like the traditional 3 times a week for 4 hours in the center. And it didn't really agree with me. A lot of the patient cohorts were a lot older than I was. They already had kind of, I guess, that stability and friendship that they had within their circle, because they had been dialyzing a lot together. Also, the fact that I was pretty young comparatively, I guess it didn't relate well. So I decided that I wanted to go home and dialyze at home, which would then give me the flexibility to decide when I wanted to dialyze, how often, how much, and, you know, it just give me that flexibility. I wasn't stuck to the hospital regime of you must come at this time on this day, etc. So I did my home training. And that was about 6 to 8 weeks approximately. So I had to learn how to needle myself. So I had to get over my needle phobia, learn how to set up the machine, take care of the machine, strip it down when my session was over, and general maintenance of how to kind of change filters on the machine and the cleaning products that are needed on the machine, and general things like that. Also, whilst going through the process of dialysis, now dialysis can be very, very draining to begin with, because it is obviously taking a lot of blood out and then kind of shoving it back in, I guess. So the first week and a half, I was literally like not taking a lot of information in. I was sleeping a lot. I was very lethargic. I was anemic at the time. I had a lot of pain in my joints. And just things weren't great. I was on food restrictions. Generally, most people, when they do start dialysis or get into dialysis for a lot longer, their urine output tends to stop. I was fortunate in that sense that my urine was still going. So I was fortunate that I wasn't on a fluid restriction. But I did still have to watch what I eat and what I drink, because basically your kidneys filter out everything you consume. So all the minerals and the electrolytes and, you know, whatever you're putting into your body, whatever your body isn't using, once it's absorbed what it does need, it gets rid of it via your urine. Now, I was still urinating, but it wasn't sufficient enough that I didn't need dialysis. So I got home and I was doing my sessions, and that was growing quite well. Even though I stuck to 4-hour sessions, I was realizing with the whole setup and then the dismantling of the machine, it was sometimes, especially if you get alarms or kinks and things like that, it can potentially take 5 hours sometimes, maybe 5.5, 6 sometimes. And I was thinking there must be a better way of being home, being better dialyzed, and also kind of not having this 5-odd hours a day of being stuck to this machine. I started researching into that. I also had some friends who are also kidney patients, and there are charities here as well that talk about it. And I found out about nocturnal dialysis. So that's basically dialyzing whilst you sleep. So again, I had to go in for the training for that, for health and safety reasons, like what potentially could or could go wrong whilst you're sleeping. During this time, the fistula that was operated on was causing some issues, and eventually kind of gave up, failed more or less, even though there were procedures done to try and kind of revive it. So sometimes they put balloons in to widen it. Sometimes they clean it out and try to get any blood clots that might be in it out. But they did quite a few of them and it just wasn't happening. And because I obviously still needed dialysis, I was given a central venous catheter, a CVC line, or a neckline, some people call it. So the line basically goes into your jugular vein, and it kind of just sits outside the heart. So it doesn't go directly into it. It just sits at, kind of outside. And again, because of the pressure of the heart, the blood that is coming out is sufficient enough to be dialyzed. So that process was being done for my line, and then also the process of learning how to dialyze safely with a line. Generally, they don't like people to have lines long term because of infection control risks and where it is placed. For myself, because I didn't have my fistula for very long, and because I was at home and I could generally self-care quite well, I kind of, in discussion with my doctors, kind of made the decision that I didn't want another surgery on my dominant arm. And if there were no problems with me keeping the line and I was dialyzing well with it and I kept within safety precautions, keeping it clean, keeping it dry during shower time, not having anyone else in the room whilst I'm connecting to the machine and disconnecting, and just generally keeping it as sterile as possible, I don't see why I would want another surgery when I have something that works. So after a little bit of persuading, they kind of said, okay, fine. But they obviously give me the whole, this can happen, this can happen, be safe, be sensible, which I was. And I ended up doing nocturnal with the neckline for about 6 years, approximately. So the benefits with nocturnal dialysis is obviously because you're on for a lot longer during the whole night. The pump speed, so at the speed that it kind of draws out the blood, is a lot lower. So it's a lot more gentle on your cardiovascular system. It also gives time for the blood to be more thoroughly cleaned. So for example, bigger molecules that might be in your blood that may not get touched in a 4-hour session, for example, because you're on it for a lot longer, you get much better clean of your blood system. So after a while, and after the nocturnal kind of regime started taking effect on my body and via blood taking, and getting that sent to the labs and getting the results back, they were all very positive, to the point where my food restrictions were kind of virtually nothing at that point. I still had side effects, things like restless leg syndrome, I was quite itchy as well, which I guess is chronic kidney disease related pruritus. So there were still things that weren't perfect, because obviously a machine is an artificial thing, so it's not going to do what the organ that you are missing is going to do as well. So although the restrictions were pretty much non-existent food-wise, there were still the pains, the aches, the cramps, being anemic. So I kind of had injections for that, where I would take, it wasn't EPO, but it was in essence EPO. It had a different brand name. But in essence, yeah, it was EPO. But it was called something else. So I had them. On occasion, I had to have iron infusions as well when my iron really did drop. And then, yeah, July 2020 came about. And then I had my third transplant, which was very weird, just because of the circumstances of the world. So at the time, it was Ramadan. And it was getting close to Eid, which is the celebration after Ramadan. So I kind of missed that because I was in hospital. So I ended up spending my time on Zoom, watching my family eat like food and getting together, etc., as much as they could with the people in the bubble. And I was kind of stuck with hospital food, which, my personal opinion, there are some people that love it. I'm not personally a huge fan of hospital food.
Not many people are.
So, yeah, I had a nice little hospital dinner whilst they were having, like, proper food. And after my transplant, because of the drug regime that changes, I was getting very hungry. So I was on certain steroids and anti-rejection medication, and my medications basically changed from being a non-transplanted patient to being a transplanted patient virtually overnight. So the effects of that kind of took me, not by surprise, because I'd had it before when I was like 14 that I remember of. But I was really hungry quite a lot. And because of COVID, whereas when I was a teenager, I just nicked down to the canteen and have whatever I wanted to have. There was no nipping out. I was literally on this ward, and whatever the hospital provided, I had to eat, which kind of sucked a little bit. But fortunately, I was off the ward in about a week or so, and things generally were going okay. So in the last year, I've pretty much been in isolation, even before my transplant, but especially after. And yeah, it's been slightly up and down since the transplant, but generally now we're almost a year in and things are settling down. Things are getting back to normal, at least kidney wise. COVID wise, maybe not so much. But yeah, things are slowly getting back to normal. There were a few hiccups along the way with this transplant. So I ended up getting something called CMV, which is quite common with transplant patients, to pick up certain infections and viruses that may come from the transplant itself, because it's from a different person, obviously. But yeah, and then obviously as the kidney was settling, certain bloods went up and down, so they needed to be kind of taken care of. And certain medications were added, but now I'm not on them anymore. So yeah, that's kind of been, I guess, a very short version of the 35 years I've lived. There are other aspects to it, like the mental health aspect, and how that affected me in school and things like that. But generally regarding transplantation, I guess for me, that's kind of how it went in my head.
Have you struggled to keep your medical records today? Do you carry huge binders from doctor to doctor only to find out you don't have what they need? Trust me, I get it. And for a long time, I pushed off the dreaded task of organizing my medical records. But procrastinate no more, people. Consolidoc is a real game changer. Consolidoc helps me collect and manage all of my medical information using one portal. Awesome, right? Well, it gets better. Once you have an account, you can submit as many record requests as you would like. And it gets better. Each one of these requests takes less than 30 seconds and poof, you're done. That's right, you heard me. You are done. The Consolidoc team takes care of the rest. And the best part? Monthly subscriptions start at $10.99 for adults. I know, is this real life? Having access on the go to all my medical records has allowed me to concentrate less on the paperwork and more on my wellness journey. So don't waste another moment. Head over, start taking control of your records your way at Consolidoc.com.
So Fez, how did you start getting involved in ambassador and advocacy work?
It was probably around the time, so I started getting into advocacy and helping other patients, probably around the time where my father came, it came to my father donating to myself. Initially, it was very, very local. It was kind of getting in touch with the local press and kind of trying to encourage people to talk about organ donation and think about organ donation, especially for people from ethnic minorities, because it's not always a subject talked about. And there can be a lot of myths around organ donation from people from different backgrounds, regarding cultural reasons or religious reasons, or just generally not being educated or informed about how the process works. So yeah, initially it was just newspaper stuff locally. And my mother had set up a group, locally as well, to help other kidney patients. And I used to attend those, and I used to kind of see how it was helping other people. I was still obviously in my teenage years then, kind of in college, that kind of thing. So I would go more to like kind of watch and learn and observe, and obviously listen to the speakers as well that were invited to attend. But I guess for myself, it really, really kicked in when I was withdrawn from university and started hemodialysis. I was invited by my KPA, which is Kidney Patient Association. So within the UK, there are quite a few kidney patient associations, and they're locally based. So I live in an area called Lancashire, and I was invited to become a committee member on our local Lancashire and South Cumbria Kidney Patient Association. That's how I initially got involved. Unfortunately, now our KPA it's kind of disbanded and doesn't exist, I guess. And that's because of COVID, and a lot of our members were from the elderly population, and they weren't that great with technology, and it was hard to kind of go out and advocate and support people, especially during COVID times. So our KPA kind of dissolved around this time. I think it was officially April when it dissolved, 2021. But through the KPA, I also got invited by NHSPT, which is NHS Blood and Transplant, to take part in something called a scheme they have called the Community Investment Scheme. And that's basically where they give individuals and also charities and public sector kind of awareness groups the opportunity to apply for funding and kind of raise awareness again around organ donation. So as at the time, I was still part of the KPA, so the Kidney Patient Association, and I was kind of the representative of the KPA, and we were put in touch with another group in this area called the Lancashire BME network. So BME being Black and Minority Ethnic Network, Lancashire being the area. And together we run this community investment scheme within the area where we held workshops, we attended health mailers, we had general talks where we invited patients and transplant surgeons, and just to raise awareness about, again, organ donation, how the process works, how it is so beneficial for people waiting on the transplant list. And we also heard stories from donor families as well, who have been so kind. And it must be a really hard, kind of difficult and emotional decision to make when that question, I guess, is asked for those families. And without those families, there wouldn't be recipients like myself. So my heart goes out to every kind of donor family out there who is willing and has said yes and has had the conversation. And yeah, it's quite emotional talking about it, because obviously somebody unfortunately has to pass away in able for people like myself and others to receive the gift of life. Because that's what it is. It's the gift of life.
I think you just actually, I want to jump in here. You kind of jumped in, like said something that like gave me the chills. And you know, it is right. Like having the conversation, like I know that I want anything that if I pass away, anything that is viable, I know that I would like to, donate. Right. But many people don't always have those conversations. And then what happens is, I know for like, if it just myself, if I passed away prior to, you know, making that decision at 18, or I didn't talk about it with everyone, I know my mother, if she was my next of kin, she would have not donated my skin because she would have wanted like me, she would have felt like that was hacking me up. Not what I wanted, right? But she would have never known my perspective of it. So it is so important to talk about these things, to bring into light, like what are your wishes? And this is not in judgment of your wishes. It's just, you know, important to discuss and have those things written down because, you know, like you said, I want my passing to mean something. And that's for me, just one of those ways where you can just, you know, how many people, you know, are connected to you. It's amazing.
Yeah, so the conversation, again, is very important. So as an organ donation ambassador, throughout the years, a lot of our work has been done around trying to get people to have the conversation, encourage people to talk to their families, whether it's at dinner time where you're all sat together to have that conversation. And maybe one conversation might be enough. Maybe you need to discuss it several times for everyone's point of view to kind of be included.
Oh, my God. Yes. Fez, say it one more time. Because, right, I understood my mom's point. Like, it's a weird position to be in, right, to think about, you know, not wanting to further hurt your family. But also, like, I love what you just said. You know, talk about it several times. Get everyone's perspective. And, you know, make the decision and have the hard conversations, even if it has to happen multiple times. Oh, say it one more time for people in the back.
Yeah. So, it's really important to have that conversation. And again, several times if needed with your family and loved ones. So here in England in May 2020, the law did change. So rather than opting in and signing up to the register, now you need to opt out. It is a soft opt out in the fact that your family always still have the final decision. So as you mentioned, your mother, for example, probably wouldn't have wanted that for yourself, but that's why the conversation is very important to have. So we've had quite a bit of messaging and marketing and advertisements done on television, radio, again, a lot of them with through the ambassadors, so they can tell their lived experience. And it could be from a donor family, so from a family who have graciously donated the organs of a loved one. It could be, for example, someone like myself who has had the honor of receiving that gift. So there is kind of, the message is getting out there. So we had hashtags like Leave Them Certain, for example, which kind of says what needs to be said, in the sense that you need to kind of leave your family certain, hence the hashtag. Also have the conversation or talk to your family or share your wishes was another one. But yeah, there are different kind of messaging that has happened throughout the year since the law change, and a lot of kind of myth busting around the myth changes, around the law change as well. There have been quite a few myths, especially like on social media messaging sites, and on groups, for example. And yeah, there's a lot of different kind of false news, I guess, for want of a better word or phrase, that has been out there since May, and tackling all of them all the time is basically what we try and do. It's kind of trying to put out these fires of false news and giving correct information and educating people properly about what has happened and what is happening, and what your decision, what your conversations, how they can affect people's lives, and decisions that have been made by donor families already, how they have meant so much to so many people. And again, especially from people from ethnic backgrounds. So we make up around 11% of the population in England, but we make up over 30% of the organ donation waiting list. So that kind of gives you an idea of the disproportionate weight that we generally have coming from an ethnic minority background, just by the sheer numbers and percentages. So it is trying to encourage more people to have those conversations. Also, there are plans to hopefully get organ donation on the national syllabus at some point. We're hoping this September, but again, with COVID, you never know how things may potentially have to change. But yeah, trying to educate young people, generally high school age and above, and also to encourage more people to have that conversation so your family can know your wishes, can respect your wishes, and you can be as selective or non-selective as you want. So, for example, in my case, I can't obviously give my kidneys because they're not mine to give. But otherwise, if everything else on my passing is okay to give, I obviously am happy to donate whatever it might be, whether that be organs, whether that be heart valves, bone, muscle, whatever is viable in me to give, I'm happy to give when I personally leave this world. And I've made that quite clear to my family, so they know my wishes. And vice versa, we've talked as a family. Now, yes, we are a family that has been affected by it, so we've had that conversation. But sometimes for families who have not been affected by it, it doesn't really pop into their head unless they are suffering the issue. And I think that goes a lot with a lot of chronic illnesses as well. Like, you don't really get chronic illness until you actually get the chronic illness.
Yes.
And it's kind of hard to kind of explain fully to people, like how it affects you kind of every day or long term. There's a very big misconception of now you've had a transplant, you're fine. But no, it's a chronic condition, so it will last for the rest of my life. I still have to take medications, maintain good water balance within my system, kind of eat healthier, exercise more, which generally people should do anyway, granted. But because I have this third chance now, there's more emphasis on myself to do those things. And I am trying. I've cut down my sugar. I've cut down my salt intake. As much as the pandemic is allowing, I am kind of working out a little bit more from home. It's not extreme working out like you might see in the gym with guys with big muscles and stuff, but I do as much as I can. And then I'm probably really tired the next day and just sleep for hours. But my family understand why. And I guess during the pandemic, in a sense, it has been a bit easier because I've not had to explain myself to people because I've not seen people. But yeah, generally when the world is open and you kind of see your friends and you see colleagues at work or whoever it may be, it's generally, oh, you've had a transplant, you're fine now. By the way, can you do like a double shift? And it's like, no, I've literally come out of surgery. It's been about 6 months. It's going to take time. But yeah, there is still that slight kind of, I guess, within the population as a whole, that thing of once you've got a transplant, that's your cure and then you're fine. But it's called chronic kidney disease for a reason, because it is chronic. And sometimes they fail. Sometimes you have to go back onto dialysis. Sometimes that vicious circle happens again. In my case, quite a few times. So yeah, it can be kind of difficult to have those conversations sometimes with people. But again, like I rather sit down and kind of explain and talk to people properly about it, rather than them just assuming what it's like or assuming that everything is fine. If someone saw me kind of on the street or, you know, in my town or whatever it is, and they didn't fully understand it, or even if they're a friend, not all your friends will fully understand either. If they approach me, for example, I'm more than happy to sit down, have a chat, and kind of explain it to them as best as I can and with my personal lived experience behind it, kind of explain to them how it works, what kind of effects it has on a human on a personal level, not only physically, but mentally as well. So yeah, it can be a bit of a hard process to go through, but I rather go through that and talk to people who want to be and want to know more about it, rather than just assume things. So yeah, I think conversation is very, very important, especially when it comes to organ donation and generally with chronic illnesses. I think the more we talk about it, the more we use spaces that are safe to talk about our illnesses, whatever they may be. If it's organ donation, it might be organ donation. If you have, I don't know, like intestinal issues, that, if it's muscle issues, bone issues, etc. I think the more we make people aware of chronic illnesses and hidden disabilities and try to make those conversations more known within communities, within countries, and around the world, I think it can only benefit us as a community of people who suffer from chronic illnesses, to make people more aware of what real life is kind of like for us and for the condition we are suffering with. Rather than using just kind of stereotype ideas that they may already have.
So Fez, I have a question. If you could only give one piece of advice to a patient who is beginning their journey, but knows that like they're going to need an organ transplant, what would that advice be?
I think my advice would be to equip yourself with as much proper knowledge as possible. So not things that you may read in a WhatsApp group or messaging service group, go to verified sources. Also, the fact that there are a lot of patients with lived experience out there, sometimes reaching out to them can help. Also, be mindful that everyone's experience is different. And everyone's tolerance to things is different. Every human being, I guess, is different. Therefore, my experience on dialysis, for example, might not be the same as someone else's experience on dialysis. So I think getting information from a lot of different sources is also very helpful. So you kind of have a broad outlook on what it could be. Like best case scenario, worst case scenario, what could happen, what might happen. And that way you can kind of prepare yourself in, I guess, internally within yourself of what to expect or what could potentially happen if things go well, if things go bad. And also looking at websites that are like official sources of information. So whether that be organ donation, whether that be organ donation websites, whether that be regarding kidney health, there are quite a few big charities here that could help. If it's a different organ that you are suffering from kind of loss of function and you think you will need a transplant for a different organ, again, there will be relative charities relevant to that organ to go and research and see how the process works, to see kind of what you may or may not be restricted on, what may or may not happen. But I guess to find as many verified sources of information as you can, so you can prepare yourself on what kind of could be happening or what could happen, and then at least you kind of have that knowledge or a build-up of knowledge to start with before just going into it blind. And also I found for myself when I was starting dialysis, as I mentioned, it can be very tiring. I would fall asleep a lot during the start. So anytime I would have a question or a thought that I would want to take to my physician, doctor, etc., I would write it down before I'd forget, because one of the side effects also was brain fog, so I would forget things. I guess writing things down a lot and finding variable sources to get information from, and if you can, and if you feel comfortable, finding other patients that have gone through similar experiences. Again, I wouldn't take every patient as gospel because every patient is different. But it is nice to kind of have an area where you can go where those people can somewhat kind of reciprocate what you are going through, which may not always be available in real life, so to speak. I guess those would be my kind of 2-3 ideas of what to do if you were fresh into kidney failure.
Oh, that's great advice for not only kidney failure, but also just people who are going through any type of like chronic invisible illness. I think, you know, you hit some really awesome points. I mean, I love talking to you, Fez. I love that I was able to connect with you through Clubhouse. I feel very grateful for that. You've always been just so such a pleasant energy despite all you've gone through. So how can people connect with you, like if they would like to reach out to learn more?
So there is Clubhouse, of course, as you've mentioned. Not everyone has Clubhouse, I get that, but I'm also available on other social media networks. So I'm on Instagram. Again, on Instagram, it's my name, Fez Awan. On Twitter, I'm at Fezzy. On Facebook, again, same name, Fez Awan. also am part of some, apart from being an organ donation ambassador, I'm also a part of the Renal Patient-Led Advisory Network, which is RPLAN for short. And basically, we work within the Northwest with five of our NHS trusts, advocating for patients and also advising the Northwest NHS England Renal Network, which will hopefully be a way of quality improving our area services, but also getting patients involved in that to make sure that the suggestions we put forward to the trusts and to Northwest NHS England regarding renal treatments, etc., that they are listened to. So yeah, they again, that group is also available online. If you type in RPLAN, so the letter R and then plan, it should come up on all platforms, so Facebook, Twitter.
Fez, thank you for that, all that great information and those nuggets. As always, Peace, we're going to go ahead and link everything that Fez just said down in the show notes. So it's clickable, easy access. Go ahead, give him a follow. You know, his heart and soul is amazing. Fez, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure. Thanks.
As always, thank you to our listeners for tuning in every week and helping us bridge the gap between rare disease and the rest of the world. Until next time, live large and stay rare.
Catch us next week for another episode. To continue the conversation about rare disease and all the unknowns that comes with it, join our Facebook group. Want even more rare? Become a VRP member on Patreon and learn more about our stories or how to share yours by visiting bwspod.com.